We're in a pandemic, a race moment, problems with the economy, but this is also a China moment. The virus likely started there, and think of the trade and tariff wars. So we want to take a step back to look at a fascinating new book about China's evolution and the important role played by Jews. Yes, two Jewish families whose massive business empires and work rescuing refugees in World War II helped shape the country we see today, especially Shanghai. Jonathan Kaufman is author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, the rival Jewish dynasties that helped create modern China. He's also director of the Journalism School at Northeastern University. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and this is nothing less than, you know, the history of China over the last several hundred years. So we're going to have to hopscotch through. It reads at times like an epic or a masterpiece theater. We have these two families, the Sassoons, the Kadouris. The Sassoons come to China first from Baghdad. David Sassoon, the patriarch, fleeing mistreatment in the early 1800s with just a shirt on his back. And with eight sons, he builds this billion-dollar dynasty that, as you write, would bankroll a king and advise prime ministers and educate others through a school system. Eli Kadouri was a student. He'd then go build his own family dynasty, becoming one of the richest men in Asia. The Kadouris, the Sassoons. How did this happen? Like, what was the pull of it? It wasn't really China, it was Shanghai. What was the pull?
Well, I think what we tend to forget sometimes is that some empires are built on military or on missionaries. This was really built on business. When the British opened up China during the Opium Wars in the 1840s, their goal was to make China a place where people could make money. And the Sassoons were, at that point in India, David Sassoon was dabbling in the opium trade, and he saw this great opportunity. And so he had eight sons and began to deploy his sons across China to see if he could open up markets. And Shanghai became the place where, if you were young and ambitious, it was the place to go.
And there's a little bit of a whiff of colonialism here. I mean, you say opium, it's kind of like the Kennedy family, you know, made their money on trade of alcohol. This was something that not everybody approved of. I mean, there were people who were saying this opium is not helping our injured Chinese workers. It's making them addicts. I mean, there was some controversy over the way they made their money.
There was, and I think the analogy is probably close to the cigarette and alcohol industry, as you say, with the Kennedys, which is opium was legal at this time. There's no question that the Chinese were opposed to it. But one of the geniuses, the business geniuses of the Sassoons, was that they found a way to exploit the sale of opium in a way that managed to both monopolize the production of it in India. They then shipped it to China and then worked with Chinese middlemen to then sell it in Chinese shops. And I think in the end, the moral concerns were something that they didn't think about very much.
They also built huge hotels, whole school systems, dabbled in rubber, electricity. You've described their businesses, even with criticism of the opium trade, you've described their businesses as enlightened. How so?
Well, I think, you know, Shanghai before the Sassoons and the Kadouris arrived was, it was a big city, but it was really a backwater. And what the Kadouris and the Sassoons did with their hotels and their other investments was really put Shanghai on the map. And they gave it, by the 1890s, Shanghai had a very advanced transportation system, a gas system, electricity. It had those incredible buildings that we see now along the waterfront, along the Bund. It had as many skyscrapers as cities like Chicago. You had thousands of people coming on cruise ships to stay at these hotels and experience China, Charlie Chaplin, Noel Coward. It was a place suddenly that everyone wanted to visit. It was the Paris of the East, and the Sassoons and the Kadouris were very much part of creating that atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much here. I mean, we're just a few decades after a penniless father arrived when we've got this magnificent dynasty. But we must fast forward because it's time to land in the 1930s. And here we are in an old noir black and white movie, Victor Sassoon, descendant of David, the looks of a film actor, maybe the lifestyle too. And thousands of Jews are fleeing Europe ahead of World War II and the Nazis. And the senior, Eli Kadouri, of the other family, in an encounter between these rival empires, tells Victor, stop being a playboy and help form a united front on refugees. And they do. Just briefly, what do they do to bring Jews from Europe?
Well, the Jews are fleeing Europe because there's no other place they can go. Every other city, every other country has shut the doors. But Shanghai, because it's occupied by the British, by the Americans, by the Japanese, is an open city. But the important thing is the Japanese are tightening a noose around Shanghai. They've invaded China, and the Japanese are allied with the Nazis. And Victor Sassoon essentially produces one of the great con jobs in world history, where he basically helps convince the Japanese that he is so influential and that Jews are so influential that they can help keep the Japanese from going to war with the United States and with Great Britain. The Japanese are somewhat anti-Semitic already. They're very suspicious of Jews. They believe Jews do control the world. And Victor Sassoon decides he's not going to disabuse them of that notion, but instead will sort of string them along by inviting them to his nightclubs, to his parties, all the time saying, let these Jews stay and I'll try to work on things behind the scenes. In truth, behind the scenes, he was spying on the Japanese. He was, some believe, working for British intelligence. He was buying up land in South America, believing that perhaps he could resettle Jewish refugees there, until finally the Japanese caught on and Victor had to flee the country just before Pearl Harbor.
In fact, they had been living in this secluded, you know, marble-floored, gilded area within Shanghai, but that, as you say, the noose is tightening. And along the way, though, the families have interactions with Chiang Kai-shek, the anti-communist nationalist leader, Mao Zedong, the communist counter-revolutionary, Sun Yat-sen, as you write, China's George Washington, who overthrew the empire. I mean, it's just so remarkable. But the gilded cage gets dismantled. What happened?
I think in the end, the Kadoris and the Sassoons were brilliant businessmen, but politically, they missed the rise of communism. I mean, you speak to their children and grandchildren today, they acknowledge that. They put all their bets on the nationalists, and the Kadoris were much the same way. So they, after World War II, when the Americans liberate Shanghai, the Sassoons and the Kadoris come back thinking they can resume life as normal. But of course, they can't. And they end up losing everything in Shanghai. The Sassoons leave and they never go back. The Kadoris go to Hong Kong and decide that they're going to try to do it differently. And they recognize that they were part of what led to the rise of communism, the inequality, the great wealth amidst great poverty. But at the same time, they also feel they should do more for the Chinese. And so one of the things the Kadoris do is they rebuild their fortune in Hong Kong, is they end up helping 300,000 Chinese refugees, helping them start small farms, small plots where they can make a living. And they try to correct some of the mistakes they saw that the earlier generations had made. And it pays off for them. They become incredibly wealthy and then return to China in the 1970s and 80s, richer than ever.
Hmm. You have one scene where I think it's a grandson, Michael, comes back after China slowly opens after 1979 and slowly opens, still a communist country. But he goes back years later and finds the family servant who helped raise him. And there's, you know, emotional tears are spilled. But you stumbled on this when you were a young foreign correspondent in the late 70s. You say the country was drab after 30 years of communist totalitarianism. But then you suddenly land in a former Sassoon hotel and you see marble stairways and chandeliers, and what was this? And there beneath the grime, you start to find this story of this opulence. What do you think they meant, if anything, to modern China today, to China's opening, to China's sense of business? Is there a connection?
I think often when we tell history, we're focusing on the politicians, on the generals, but we don't really talk as much about the role of business and companies and businessmen. And this story is a family saga, but it's also a story of how important business was in the development of China. I think the other part of it is that the Chinese really suppressed this history for decades. They didn't want to talk about it. Their narrative was that China was conquered by foreigners, and then the communists came along, kicked the foreigners out, and then the communists led China into the 21st century. But in some ways, this became, for me, almost an alternate history of China. This was a China that was much more cosmopolitan, much more globalized. And you can see that today. Anybody who goes to China or reads about it sees how Shanghai is such a different city than Beijing or than any other city in China. And that's because of these families. I think part of what's going on now is that China is turning inward again. It's turning nationalist again. And when you talk to people in Shanghai, they're uncomfortable with that. And when you talk to many Chinese, they talk with affection about these families because they brought such a beautiful lifestyle to the city in some ways, while recognizing there was also incredible inequality. And I think the choice for China now is, will they continue to go that route of being open to the West, of welcoming people all over the world the way Shanghai always did, or will it become more insular, more inward-looking, more repressive? And I think Shanghai represents a different future, the same way it represented a different past.
Jonathan Kaufman, author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Jonathan, I smell movie.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of interest. And I think these days when we're all at home and looking for good books to read and good things to watch on television, why not?
And you could start on the screenplay. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.